I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line, Thriving in the Flat Recovery with Victor Cheng. This is a very cool topic. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services, and we'll be hosting our program today. We have a few housekeeping items, and we'll jump into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement to help keep people and organizations off the rocks of potential self-destruction. We do this through our in-depth work style assessments to raise the hiring bar, and we assist sales and operations to avoid getting stuck in shallow waters so they have smooth sailing. Don't you like that?
I do. Very eloquent.
We also offer a number of workshop topics to associations and trade organizations, and if you'd like more information, please email me as indicated on your screen. Our Keeping on Track open line series is in response to a number of calls we've been getting from many of our clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that most organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion, and we'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible. So please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we're going to open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. You'll also want to have some paper and a pen handy to take notes, since we'll be sharing many ideas that you can consider and implement with your team and trusted advisors. Our special guest with us today is Victor Cheng, who is a revenue growth consultant. I love that title. That shows CEOs how to grow their companies even in a severe recession. He specializes in strategic planning, extreme market differentiation, and business reinvention. He has been featured on as a business expert by the Fox Business Television Network, MSNBC, Time Magazine, the Harvard Business Review, the Wall Street Journal, Fortune Small Business, Smart Money Magazine, Inc. Magazine, and the list goes on and on and on. Victor is a graduate of Stanford University, a former McKinsey consultant, and the author of the books The Recession-Proof Business, Lessons from the Greatest Recession Stories of All Time, and Extreme Revenue Growth, the Guide for Silicon Valley CEOs. I feel privileged to have Victor with us today and to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. Also, registration for our next program will begin at the end of today's program, and the topic will be leadership, how to listen to your inner compass. Victor, welcome. The show is yours.
Dana, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity. Why don't I just go ahead and jump in here. I have one little caveat. This presentation I'll share today is condensed from a four-hour presentation. So if I need to skip a bullet or two here, that's not that important. If I can have that permission to do that, that
sure.
Great. Let me give you just an overview of what I'll cover today. This recovery that we're in is, I think, a very fragile recovery. And even though the growth is positive, I think from an experiential standpoint, feels very, very flat for a number of reasons. And the tips for staying ahead of that change are sort of four key ideas. And I'll tell you where this information comes from. When the recession started, I did some research around companies going back 136 years. What did they do differently to not just survive their economic crises of the day, but to thrive? I think a lot of companies have went into the recession and this sort of terribly unexciting recovery have been taking an approach of playing to not lose, which is very different than playing to win. And so I looked for companies that played to win and did win in a very big way, looking for small, medium-sized companies that grew to be sort of enormous giants and started, in a very difficult economic times, either a recession or a depression. And what I discovered was the companies that thrived, they all did four things extremely consistently. And these four things were almost formulaic. And so what I want to do is describe what these four things are. And they are very simple to understand. You just follow these four things, your business grows irrespective of the environment. Now, it's not always easy to execute. That's the hard part. But it is very simple to understand. So my goal today is to explain what those four things are. And I'll do so by giving you sort of a high-level overview to start. And then we'll talk about some specific examples to sort of bring those points home. So let me just start with the big overview. Four big strategies for thriving, even in the flat recovery. Number one is focusing on the opportunities that are still left in the economy, not those that have disappeared. And I'll give you a quick example. About a year and a half ago, the news was covering the unemployment problem in the country. And the big news of the day that particular day was the country had lost 500,000 jobs. That was the lead story in the New York Times, the Journal, all the major networks, and online. And I tend to ask sort of these contrarian questions. It's kind of how my mind works. And I wondered that day, I understand the unemployment rate went up. I understand we lost 500,000 jobs. But I wonder how many jobs we kept. You know? And I read every article, and not a single article or news story covered that number.
That's a great question.
And I looked it up, but it took me like half an hour to find it. And it turns out that particular month when we lost 500,000 jobs, we kept 154 million jobs within the United States. So 154 million American households still had a paycheck. This was back in the throes of the Great Recession. And what's interesting, though, is you look at the companies, the executives and the CEOs of companies in the past, what they do very differently is this. They look at their marketplaces and they say, you know, I think there's a better opportunity to serve the 154 million customers that still have an income versus the 500,000 that just lost theirs. Let's build our business plans, our operating plans, and our sales plans around serving those who still have money. That's a big shift, and it is not what most people do. Most people, psychologically, it's human nature, we are far more programmed to pay attention to loss, you know, than to opportunity and gain. So, for example, if I was willing to give you a $100 bill, but you had to take it out of my hand within a second, and you were a little slow and you missed it, typically you kind of feel like, oh, okay, you know, it was too bad, I was a little late on that. That's the typical reaction people have. But then if I went into your wallet and stole $100, right, how would you feel about that? Typically people aren't as happy about that, but it's still $100.
Right.
So $100 missed in terms of opportunity doesn't hurt so bad. $100 stolen from you hurts a lot. It turns out in terms of the research, it's twice as bad. So $100 stolen from you feels twice as bad as $100 you could have gotten, but you missed out on. So when we look at the economy, economic news, what you'll find is that when you see even a small bit of bad news, it psychologically hurts the human psyche a lot more than looking for opportunity. So what the CEOs and executives of the past have done is they focus on the opportunities that are still left. Second big idea is piggyback on some change in customer spending trends. And there are a lot of changes in this economy. That's the big message here on this one. It's not so much the economy is bigger or smaller. It's very much the fact that it's a very different economy today than it was 3 or 4 years ago. So I'll give you a simple example. If you recall, Dana, the U.S. auto industry at the outset of the recession had sales fall about 50%, you know, cut in half for new car sales. And the general perception most people have is, wow, the auto industry has gotten hit very, very hard. And it turns out that is not true. That is not factually true. There are actually five sectors of the U.S. auto industry that continue to do well. Either they had a very small hit in sales, or were actually holding steady. And if you think about it, it actually kind of potentially makes sense. If you look at the number of driver's licenses that are issued and in circulation and active in the United States, that number has not fallen in half in the last 2 or 3 years. If you look, numbers still have to go from point A to point B every morning. That number of people has not fallen in half. So the demand for transportation, you know, continues to be quite strong. So there are five sectors of the auto transportation industry that have done well. One is used car transactions. If you're not going to buy a new car, people are buying used cars. So eBay Motors continues to do well. Certified used cars, one of the major sectors in the auto industry that's growing. You're finding that there's one big trend I see in a lot of industries in this last couple of years in the economy. It's called downshifting. And downshifting basically is taking a market category where you are normally buy at a certain level and you downshift to a lower level. So someone who used to buy a new car would now buy a certified used car, for example. Someone who used to buy a certified used car and can't afford it might now buy just a regular private party used car. Someone who used to buy a used car is now keeping their car and now sending it to the mechanic. So you see auto repair sales, they took about a 10% hit in the first year of the recession, in the second year and beyond, they've been relatively flat. It's a little more proportional to where drivers are in the country. And for those who can't afford to take the car to the mechanic but still got to drive, they're doing it themselves. So you're seeing retail sales of auto parts. Craigman, Pep Boys, the suppliers like Napa Auto Parts, their sales are through record highs. Their stock prices this year, record highs. So those are four sectors in particular doing well. And the fifth one is hourly car rentals. So a company called Zipcar, and they're based on college campuses and in urban city centers. And rather than having a rental car depot at the airport, they have like one car at each Safeway, you know, each grocery store in the neighborhood. And they rent the car by the hour. And their argument is, you know, why own a car for like 600 hours out of the month when you drive five? Right? Just pay a little extra for the five. You'll save more money in the end. No insurance, no gas, no loan payment. So overall, the demand for auto transportation continues to be just fine. Now, what's happened in that industry in particular, which is very illustrative of this trend change more than anything else, is a lot of Americans have been doing what I've been doing. Is I get up in the morning, I look at my car, and I say, you know, Dana, I think it'll be okay for another year. Like, it'll do. It's good enough. And it's that preference change that a lot of Americans have been making that has hurt Detroit a lot, not so much that the economy has shrunk by 4 or 5%. Because when the economy shrinks 4 or 5%, why does sales fall 50%? Doesn't tell the whole story. So that's a big, important trend. We'll give you some more examples of that in a second.
Interesting. It's helpful. Perspective.
And then the third point here is extreme differentiation. The companies that have thrived, not just surviving, but thriving in particular, companies that thrive, they are really different. If you look at the financial statements, for example, of Apple, you don't see the recession. You don't see, like, this flat recovery. You just see this growth company. But what you notice is, like, what has Apple had to do to pull off that kind of growth? You know, they've invented in the last 2 years, they've invented an entire new industry, right? Even actually arguably two industries between the iPhone and the iPad, creating entirely new categories, radically different products, where at the outset they had really sort of no direct competition in many respects. So the bar is high, but the bar is not impossible to reach. But it is definitely very high. So we'll talk more about how to do that in a second. And the last theme I've noticed from companies that have done very well historically is they're very aggressive in their sales and marketing when they have sort of followed these other key strategies, and only when they follow these other key strategies. So companies that are focusing on opportunities that are still left in the economy, those that are aligning themselves with the prevailing customer trends, the ones that are in process as opposed to what used to be true, and those that offer something different and unique that customers can't get from competitors. When you have that kind of perfect storm situation, you know, it really pays to be very aggressive in sales and marketing. The reverse is true, though. You know, if you're out of alignment with the marketplace, you know, you're selling something customers used to want but no longer do, if what you offer really, you know, when you really think about it, is kind of identical to what your competitors offer, you know, them being more aggressive in sales and marketing typically doesn't pay very well. So that's when it sort of depends on whether you've done the first three items. So in a nutshell, those are sort of the four key themes from companies that have thrived in the past. And then what I thought I'd do, if it makes sense to us, just sort of walk through some examples of each one to sort of bring these points home.
That'd be perfect.
Okay, great. Let's do that. Let's talk first about focusing on the opportunities that are still left. First off, there's a lot of money that's still out in the economy. U.S. GDP, I think last month was about $14.9 trillion, which is the size of the U.S. economy. And that's about that's larger than where the economy was the month prior to the stock market crash. And so the challenging question is, I always ask everyone is, you know, given this $14.9 trillion circulating out there, you know, is there enough there, you know, to meet your financial objectives for this year? And I'd argue for most people there probably is. Now the trick is you got to go find it. That's the harder part. Second big thought is to be very careful of the news media. And Dana, in your introduction to me, you were, you know, kind enough to mention some of the publications and media properties that I've been associated with. And that is not something I have historically done. It's sort of a relatively new thing for me. And I've been very interesting. I've been finding the whole process of being a media insider very interesting. It works not in ways that I would have anticipated. And so I'll sort of share with you how the news business works It's very eye-opening. First off is to realize that the news business is, in fact, a business. And their business is getting you to pay attention so they can sell advertising. If you do not pay attention, there is no advertising. They go out of business. And so there's a huge financial incentive to run news stories, for example, on the news, that people will actually pay attention to. So there are a couple types of stories that typically do not drive viewership and therefore do not get covered. Bad news sells a lot better than good news. So the highest ratings week in the entire U.S. news industry was the week after 9/11. Everyone was watching every channel, watching, reading multiple papers and surfing online on news sites all at the same time. So bad news sells better than good news. So you tend to see a lot more bad news on TV than good. Now, you have to be careful, because if you don't know this is happening, you might assume that that's because there's only bad news happening in the world, and when, in fact, that's not the case. It's just that the bad news gets more coverage. So, for example, every year in the United States, about 35,000-40,000 people get killed in a car accident every year. And I forget the exact numbers, but on any given day or any given week, there are like 30,000 kids being born. The births rarely get covered. The bad accidents, particularly the gruesome ones, get covered because they're unusual. So you just have to realize that that sort of whole thing is happening. Also, in terms of expert commentary, since I have been one, was particularly for Fox, the way you become an expert commentary type personality on television is, for the very first time, is to have good credentials. That's very important. What's interesting is what gets you invited back the second, third, and fourth time. It has nothing to do with your credentials, and it has nothing to do with the accuracy of your forecasts. It has everything to do with having something interesting to say on air and saying it in a really interesting way. So the commentators that get invited back the most are the ones that drive the most ratings, not necessarily the ones that are most precise or accurate. That was the feedback I got from my first interview. It was not, because we appreciate your interview, you know, what brilliant insight, you're a genius. No, it was none of that. It was like great energy, great repartee with the host. You know, we want you back. And I'm like, huh? Like, how is that even relevant? And so apparently I'm charming enough to be on the air, but not brilliant enough, because they don't care about the brilliant stuff.
That's funny.
It's kind of disappointing. Because I'd rather be brilliant than charming, but oh well. But I'll take what I can get, right?
You know, right.
Work with what you got.
Right.
So be careful about that, and don't assume that the news is accurate. Take it with a grain of salt and realize that what they're doing is just trying to drive their net income. It's a business, and they're just trying to improve their sales. So just an important thing to keep in mind. Last point here on focusing on the opportunities that remain is this idea of adaptation. This is something I think a lot of companies, the ones that have gone under, were just not good at. And this idea that you need to adapt your company and your business or you risk dying, I think is very, very appropriate for this environment. So I'll share one very quick story. There is one industry in particular that a researcher studied at in New York City. And it's a service sector business that serves a Wall Street executive. And the focus of the research was, what happens to the service business that serves Wall Street executives when Wall Street has a major problem, like a stock market crash, and these executives take a financial hit? This is a very well-respected researcher, and he's the author of the book called The Underground Economy, kind of studies different kinds of businesses that don't normally get a lot of coverage. And the business he studied was the high-priced call girl industry of New York City. And he found that, and he's really dick, he followed a group of 300 entrepreneurs in this one particular underground business over a 15-year period, and he ran financial statements for them every 2 years over a 15-year period, and started doing dashboard metrics, financial ratio analysis, revenue per client. Turns out, and by the way, in recessions they have receivables. So they're doing balance sheet math like days outstanding, all the kind of math that a CFO would normally do, and he was doing this for these entrepreneurs. And then he also watched the revenue mix, like what sells, what doesn't sell in a down market. And the story I'll share, it's PG-13, so it's appropriate for the audience, but it's very interesting. There's a really powerful lesson that I want to share. What this researcher noticed was is a major shift in what sells well in a stock market crash to that particular audience. And what he noticed was that the top-selling service in the high-priced call girl industry of New York City after a stock market crash is not what you think it is. It is actually the service of listening. So then listening is like the hot seller in a stock market crash. And here's why. So I'll stereotype a little bit, mostly for amusement value. Wall Street guys, you know, typically a guy, goes in Monday morning, loses $250 million. Guy's having a bad day. Can't go home too stereotypical, quote-unquote, trophy wife, because trophy wife will leave him. Can't complain to his friends at work because Wall Street's a very macho culture. You show weakness today, you know, basically they'll make fun of you for the rest of your life. So you can't share your pain with the coworkers. And so this Wall Street executive goes to the high-priced entrepreneurs in this particular industry, and we know empirically they don't buy what they usually buy. They are too depressed to want sex. So what they want to do, however, is they want to complain to somebody. They want to complain. And so the entrepreneurs of the oldest profession on planet Earth, they survive for a reason. They adapt so they don't die. And they've discovered that in that kind of market condition, that it is far easier to sell $10,000 a night therapy sessions than to sell what they normally do. So they're smart. They figured it out. And they switch. They adapt and they evolve to the times. Now, the underlying lesson, which I think is very useful for everyone, your business, Dana, and mine, as others, is what business are they really in? The high price call goals of New York City, what business are they really in? The business they're really in, the business we should all be in, is to be in the business of just selling what our customers want to buy right now. Not what they used to buy, not what you think they should be buying, not what they need, but just figuring out what is it that they actually want to buy right now, and then find some way to give it to them. And that's really it. It's funny, when most people introduce themselves in a social setting, most people will introduce themselves by describing what their company sells. You know, so I'm, you know, XYZ CPA firm, and we sell tax services. You know, or I'm an attorney, and we provide legal services. And when I'm asked to introduce myself, I never say this out loud, but I'm always thinking it in my head. And the thought in my head is, you know, my name is Victor Chang, and I'm in the business of providing what my clients want to buy. And I'm really flexible on that, as long as they keep buying. And I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I have in these past 4 or 5 years evolved my business quite a bit. Business has been extremely good. But the business that was here 4 or 5 years ago was very different than it is today. And I find the companies that have done well in this economy, you know, they look a lot different than what they used to be like. They definitely have changes, and those who can embrace the change and take advantage of the change are the ones that typically thrive the most.
How did you identify how to bring about the change or serve the client differently? Because they may not be able to articulate it.
Yeah, I think the big thing is to understand what your clients are going through. And the advanced thing that no one ever does, but this is where I typically get a lot of my breakthrough ideas. So everyone knows you got to talk to your customers, figure out what they want, and so you get, and you can adapt to that. But the real secret is not to just interview your customers and learn from them, but to interview and learn from your customers' customers. So go back 2 layers, not just one. Because your customers, particularly in a business-to-business context, whatever they're going to do in the next 6 months is largely going to be driven by what their customers are demanding of them. So if you get ahead of the curve and you figure out how your customers' customers are changing, then you can predict what your customers are going to do in about 6 months. So you get a head start, typically about 6 to 12 months head start over your competition. So that's sort of one very practical way to figure out, you know, what the customer needs are changing and getting on top of that. So in the auto industry, for example, their big problem was is how they saw themselves. I'll back up for 1 second just to interject to answer your point more clearly. There's a Stephen Covey, who is like the Seven Habits of How You Affect the People, that person. He has this framework called See, Do, Get. See meaning what you see drives what you do. What you do determines what results you get. And I think that, and his argument is, if you do not like what you get, rather than just trying to change what you do, oftentimes it's more powerful if you just change what you see. So I'll give you a very simple example. If you look at the executives in Detroit, you know, they see themselves as in new auto manufacturing. They're in the business of manufacturing and selling new cars. Now, if you think about it from a consumer standpoint, what do consumers want to buy? Why do they buy a car? Most typically for the transportation capability. So consumers see it as the auto transportation industry. The big three, they see it as we're in the new car manufacturing business. And that definition is very important. And had GM and Ford and Chrysler, they redefined their business as we're in the business of helping Americans or our customers get you from one place to the other through automobiles, then that's a very different perspective on the business. You start thinking about car rentals, you start thinking about auto parts services, you start thinking about used car transactions, you start seeing suddenly that your marketplace is five times bigger than you thought it was. So that whole perspective, I think, is very important. And so when you start looking for at your customers and your customers' customers, as you understand what changes they're going through, it makes it much easier to understand how you can play, what you can do to get ahead of the change and make it easier for them to be successful in whatever pressures they're facing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a funny story. One of the things I do, I'm a parent. I have three young girls, and I'm sort of extremely nervous that when they hit puberty, I'm going to freak out. And so one of the things I do, and people are sort of surprised by it, is I'm an avid reader of Cosmo Girl, which is the teenage version or preteen version for Cosmopolitan magazine, the one with sort of all the very attractive women on the covers, typically for the adult version. And people always wonder, why, are you some kind of weirdo? Why do you read, a teenage girl magazine? And the reason I say is, I want to know who my enemy is, right? That's my competition in a couple of years, and I want to know what they're saying, so I can inoculate my girls against it today.
That's funny.
So it's a lot of perspective, right? If you know, and by the way, it's terrible stuff. Every page in that magazine starts with the premise of how young girls are basically flawed, until they fix the pimple, fix their hair, wear this piece of dress, that kind of stuff. And it's 85 pages of basically you're screwed up, but we can fix you if you buy stuff. So it just laced with all this psychology in there, and I was just shocked by it. And so now that I see that, then I have to sort of build out my girls up in a certain way so when they hit that they see it for what it really is. So I'm trying to get a head start on that.
Good luck.
Good luck. All right. I'll let you know how it goes in about 10 years. So let's move on here. So strategy number one, focus on opportunities that are still left in the economy. And once you do that, what you're able to do then is pay attention to the changes in customer trends, which is very important. So I'll give you, I have two examples here. I'll just share one of them that I think really brings this point home the most. There is a company in Plano, Texas I met, the owner of, and it's a sign company. They manufacture and install new signs for new retail stores. And the problem in Plano, Texas, from about a year back or so, was there are not a lot of new retail stores, unfortunately, that are opening up, in that area. And so the owner of the business was telling me that, his business was down, not surprisingly. But he said, but there's two parts of my business that are actually doing quite well. And sales are up over 300% year over year in two sectors of my business. And my reaction was, well, what are they? What could possibly be growing in that kind of environment? And what he said was that we have, we're selling two things that are extremely well. The first is we're selling a lot of going out of business. Everything's on sale signs. So that's like a hot seller. And then the second hot seller is they're serving a very different kind of customer. Normally they serve the business owner who's putting up a new sign for their store. Now they're finding they're serving a lot of property owners, and they're selling sign removal services. So when a tenant goes under and moves out, the property owner wants to take out and remove all the old signage so that the prospective tenants will know it's vacant and inquire and hopefully rent it. And so what happens is when I mention this story to most people, initially they can't figure out what could possibly be growing 300% per year in this kind of a business. And then after the fact, it seems so obvious in hindsight. So it's just a difference in perspective. And the reason I mention it, Dana, is because this particular individual was so conflicted about it. He did not want this change to be happening. And the challenge, I think, was, in his original business, he saw himself as a respected member of the community. He helps others succeed. It was a very proud and noble profession. And now he realizes that he's profiting from other people's misery, when they go under, he makes money. So he's become this ambulance chaser, and he does not like that role. And the only role he does not like more than being the ambulance chaser was after about 3 or 4 months, he realized that unless he changed, he was going to head into bankruptcy. And so he finally sort of, you know, woke up and said, okay, I see this opportunity. It's what the market wants. I give up. I'm just going to sell the customers what they want to buy right now. You know, that same lesson we learned from the Congos in New York City. So his version of listing services as a hot seller on Wall Street in the down market, his version is selling going out of business lines, sales lines, and sign removal services. And that change was very hard for him emotionally to make. For the reasons I just read. So for everyone on today's call, you want to look at the changes that are happening in your marketplace, and the mindset shift I would encourage is how do you keep up with the change, but to look at the direction of the change and leapfrog it. How do you get about 6 months to 12 months ahead of the change to be where the market will be in about half a year to a year, and a lot of markets I see what I call writing on the wall trends. So, for example, about 11 years ago, it was a lot of debate around jobs that are being shipped offshore. And that time, there's like a lot of jobs to India and the call centers and whatnot. And I remember looking at that, and most Americans were trying to fight it, trying to legislate against it. And then I had some experience with it personally, and I realized, wow, geez, they're particularly in certain roles, they're probably only half as good as an American, but they're 90% less expensive. Right, so for certain roles, you know, it's just like such a big advantage. How could you not do it? So I sort of determined that the writing's on the wall. For certain kinds of jobs, these things are going to go overseas. Now, in every business, there typically are trends, and some trends are so strong, they've been so true for so long, and that they're what I call writing on the wall trends. And a lot of times these trends are negative, or they're perceived to be negative. So Blockbuster, for example, they saw a negative trend of movies rentals going to companies like Netflix and moving slowly over time to digital delivery. So they thought of that as a threat. I sort of saw it as a, you know, hey, writing's on the wall. And with every year, internet bandwidth gets twice as big, twice as fast, and half the price. So at some point, this internet thing's going to work to deliver video. And from Blockbuster's standpoint, their role is let's preserve the status quo as much as possible. But I think that's very risky, and as, you know, as they've gone bankrupt this year, it sort of illustrates that point. The better approach is to say, okay, if the writing's on the wall, it's all heading in this direction anyway, what do we need to do to get slightly ahead of that change so that we're in alignment with where customer demand is changing to, not where customer demand used to be? So Blockbuster failed to do that. This same company did do that. They've survived, and unfortunately a lot of his competitors are still busy trying to run the old business the old way, not realizing the world has changed. So that's my second key point, piggybacking on changes in customer trends. And the third one is always an interesting one to talk about, extreme differentiation, which is being really different than your competitors. Most people think about being better or worse, which I think is the wrong terminology. It's different or the same, I think, is a better way of thinking about it. And the key with looking at companies, and the question to ask yourself is, if in your business, if your company went out of business, would your marketplace, would the industry or consumers that you serve, would they even care or notice? Right? And if the answer is no, they wouldn't care or notice, in all likelihood, it means that your business is not that differentiated. Hmm. So I'll give you some examples. There are some examples historically. I'm trying to think of the best one here. I'll use Costco as a great example since everyone sort of knows what that is. Costco, merger of two companies, Costco and Price Club, been around for a long time. And that business started in San Diego where I grew up, so I happened to shop at the very first warehouse store in the history of the industry. I didn't realize it at the time. And the first thing you notice about Costco is when you walk in for the very, very first time is you kind of don't know what to make of it. You know, they sell food, but it's not a grocery store. They sell books, but it's not a good bookstore. So what is this thing? And that's a good thing. If it's too easy to prejudge what you do, then what happens is people tend to ignore you. So the first big advantage of being really differentiated is your prospects actually have to listen to your sales presentation to figure out if they like what you do or not. If you look too similar to your competitors, they can decide in advance it's not worth the time and not even bother. So the majority of sales that are lost today in this kind of economy are not the sales where you had contact with a prospective customer, you explained what you had to offer, and they said no. Most of the sales are lost before, not by the meetings you do get, but the meetings you never actually get at all. So that's the big problem. So another example of this is if you look at, if you've ever been in a social setting where you've met a stockbroker and you started doing the stockbroker thing, have you been in a situation like that? And if you have, I'm curious what your initial reaction was when you heard that.
Trying to think. All the same, commodity.
All the same.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in that setting will typically hang on to their wallets and try to politely exit the conversation because they know they're going to get pitched.
Right.
And the message here is, in a lot of businesses, for folks who are on listening in, sometimes in your business, you're the stockbroker. You know, you look a lot similar to all the other companies, and what happens is you never get the airtime to even make your point. So, for example, that stockbroker that most people typically ignore, you know, it's entirely possible that that stockbroker, she saved all of her clients from losing even one penny, you know, in the Great Recession. It's possible, but typically most people don't stick around long enough to find out, you know, because, you know, that business looks too similar to everyone else. So it's useful to be extremely differentiated. It helps you stand out. It helps you get considered on your merits and not discounted because you look too similar than everyone else. So that's the first big advantage, is you actually get a chance to make your case. Second big advantage of extreme differentiation is it triggers word-of-mouth marketing. You know, Costco last year did $72 billion in revenues, and they don't really have a sales and marketing budget. You know, it's all word-of-mouth. But that only happens if you're different enough than your existing competitors. So if Costco were just a grocery store, you know, I doubt they'd be at $72 billion in sales purely on word of mouth. And so with that comes the point that once you get different enough, it triggers word of mouth marketing. And the big advantage of that is, from a financial standpoint, it's a extremely efficient profit and loss statement for an economy like this. So when your sales and marketing expenses shrink, your gross profits tend to increase. And as your gross profits increase, you keep more of every dollar that you bring in sales. So CFOs love that, love word-of-mouth marketing, because it's a much higher margin business. But at the same time, people who drive, who are heads of sales, like it too, because now you're seeing revenues increase because your customers are now your unpaid sales force. So they're driving top-line growth. So you're getting the fast growth, and you're getting improving margins at the same time. And when you're pulling off word-of-mouth marketing, it doesn't require very much capital, and typically no capital. So it's extremely capital efficient for those who do not necessarily have access to additional capital to grow. So this whole differentiation point, I noticed that in all the companies I looked at going back many years, they had this point of differentiation that was really strong, and it made their businesses really thrive. So a couple examples. Charles Schwab and Vanguard Funds. Vanguard was the company that invented the S&P 500 index fund. Both of those companies started right around 73, 74, which was right at the beginning of the recovery of the recession in 72 and 73. And what you'll notice is the argument for Charles Schwab was, you know, you had your money at Merrill Lynch. They took like 5% of the money in fees, and then they promptly lost another 35% on top of that. So it's like insult to injury. Well, why not do it yourself? You couldn't do worse in terms of performance, right? You might even do better. And by the way, you cut out all the fees. So you're guaranteed at least you get the fees back. Vanguard, John Bogle at Vanguard, said, you know, statistically, if you just buy the entire S&P 500, you would have outperformed Merrill Lynch and all these sort of other companies and mutual funds. You would have outperformed them, you know, 80% of the time. So no work, no risk, you get 8% of the reward. Seems pretty straightforward. And at that time, the big trend was people were very frustrated with Merrill Lynch because they lost a lot of money, they paid a lot of fees, and paying the fees did not seem to stem the losses. So the market was ripe and open for someone to come in and do something very different than the norm. So it's not an accident that both Schwab and Vanguard funds started in essentially the same year. Very important. So that's an example of extreme differentiation. Other companies that have done that over the years include Disney had a huge innovation in the Depression around sound and animation. That's just what Mickey Mouse can bounce. And so these companies have all found something to be different about and do something unusual that made them stand out in a difficult economy and drove a huge amount of growth. So let me move on sort of to my last point here, which is around driving aggressive growth in sales and marketing. When you are focusing on the opportunities that are still left in the economy, when you are finding that customer trend that has changed and figuring how to get ahead of it, so you know there's customer demand, and when you have extreme differentiation, so you know you can distance yourself from your competitors, that's a very advantageous position to be in. Not always easy to get there, but when you're there, whether you did it deliberately or by luck, it's useful to recognize you're there. The right move in that situation is then to be very aggressive in driving sales and marketing. And a good example of this is Domino's Pizza. You know, they started in 1960, and about 12 years later, they figured out how to do delivery well. It took them a decade to figure this out. And there were a lot of little things that they did to make delivery more effective by 72. One of the things they did was, well, if we're going to be in the delivery business, why do we need, like, the dining room, the chairs and the tables? Let's get rid of all that. Well, if we're not going to have a dining room, why do we need all this rent? You know, all this such a large facility. Let's use smaller facilities to save money. You know, and if we're really a delivery business, why are we in the high price of rental retail districts where all the other restaurants are? You know, if we're in the logistics business, why don't we just get closer to customers? And so Domino's, over the first 10 years of their life, they started picking locations that were a little closer to customers, typically one or two stoplights closer to customers. And they were in little strip malls, very small footprint properties, just enough to have a cash register and a kitchen. And so now they had the right form factor, if you would, to fit into some of these smaller strip malls that were very close to customers. And then Domino's decided to go national, go really big in 72, again, another recession year, same as when they started was also a recession. And they had this whole slogan they came up with that many of you are familiar with, fresh pizza delivered to your door in 30 minutes or less, guaranteed, or it's free. And that thing worked like crazy. You know, that was their big differentiator or communication piece in the marketplace. Now, what's important about Domino's is a lot of the competitors saw this was happening, tried to copy Domino's promotion, but found that because of the way their operations were set up, these other competitors were typically delivering pizza in about 45 minutes or less. And the big issue was the stoplights. You know, across 1,000 locations, Pizza Hut had to deal with two more stoplights that Domino's didn't.
Huh.
And so this structural difference that the ad agency was very good at bringing out and exploiting the structural difference. So the genius in Domino's is not just the clever marketing, which is what most people see on the surface, but was in the completely different operating logistical infrastructure that Domino's built up over decades that was then in turn exploited by very clever marketing. It's the combination, the 1-2 punch, that is very powerful. And so the idea really here is you first determine your point of differentiation, and then you become aggressive in sales and marketing. And differentiation is not like a marketing slogan. Differentiation is just physically doing your business differently in a very different way than your competitors.
Interesting.
So that's one of my favorite stories. Cause
yeah.
I met somebody who is a friend of Tom Monahan, who was the founder of Domino's, and sort of corroborated the story and was very much very conscious about what he was doing from very early on. So again, what I'll do now is maybe just do a recap of what I covered, and then happy to answer any questions there might be. I covered sort of four key strategies for thriving in this recovery. First is to focus on the opportunities that are still left in the economy, so the equivalent of, you know, serving the 154 million Americans who still have a paycheck, not those who just lost theirs. Second big strategy is piggybacking on some kind of shift in customer trends, much like the sign company in Texas, switching from installing new signs to helping companies go out of business more efficiently, which is sort of a bit of a mindset shift for them. It was very tough for them to get around. Third point I talked about, third strategy is extreme differentiation, like the Costco. When you're different, dramatically different from your competitors, people can't help but pay attention to you to learn more, and once they like you, the word of mouth can spread, but only if you're really different. If you're just a little bit different, typically it doesn't happen. And the fourth point is to do a Domino's, which is be aggressive in sales and marketing when you've got the rest of these strategies figured out and implemented first. So on that note, that's the key points I want to cover today. And Dana, happy to answer any questions that people might have and whatever the next step would be to do that. Happy to
Okay, great. In just a few minutes, after we conclude this show, we're going to turn off the recording and we're going to open up the line so you'll have an opportunity to talk with Victor. You'll see on your screen the area to register for our upcoming March 24th, 2011 open line program, which is entitled Leadership, How to Listen to Your Inner Compass. Please sign up today and reserve a space for yourself and let us know if you'd like your staff or other colleagues to attend. In the next few days, you'll receive a recording and PowerPoint for today's program. And please feel free to share it with others in your organization or within your association. Please, again, stay on the line. I just want to wrap up here, then we'll open up the line. Victor and I want to thank you for your time today and for all the valuable ideas that were shared. If you'd like to contact Victor to have further discussion on specifics about your industry, your team, or to have some one-to-one time together or discuss any of the ideas shared today, you'll see Victor's contact information on the screen. The information shared today is a property of Lighthouse Consulting Services, LLC, located in Santa Monica, California. And our mission statement is to bring effective insight to your organization. If you'd like more information on our services, please write me at dana@lighthouseconsulting.com. If you have other topics you'd like us to address, just let us know. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you join us for our next Keeping on Track Open Line program. Have a great day. Hold the line. Let me stop the recording, and we'll be right back.